From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzette Gorlot, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies, and welcome to Worldviews. Today, I'll talk with Joshua Landis about the ongoing removal of chemical weapons in Syria, and Rebecca Cruz examines the recent executions of high-level government officials in North Korea and what they could mean.
And he has to gather power. He has to bring power to the fore. And how do you do this but incite fear?
And later, a conversation with a trio of scientists about how three very different developing countries share many of the same sanitation and hygiene concerns.
Limitations in terms of water supply or water treatment technologies.
Children are getting sick. People are dying early.
High fluoride, arsenic, nitrate.
Water issues in Ethiopia, China, and India. The news is next. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorlot. Rebecca Cruz, Joshua Landis. Let's talk about some of the issues in the news this week. First, Rebecca, North Korea. It's actually been going on for a couple of weeks now, but it appears that their leader, Kim Jong-un, is kind of stepping up, purging of their inner circle. We've had a number of executions. He executed his uncle, 9 members of the National Orchestra. People are being imprisoned. They're saying they have to go in for re-education, that they're ideologically impure. So I guess he's feeling some perhaps are challenging his authority. What's going on here in North Korea? Or even can we even know what's going on here in North Korea?
Well, certainly this has been in the news a lot the last couple of weeks. But unfortunately, it isn't anything new. In fact, only 2 weeks after he took office, about 2 years ago, there was a series of purges. In fact, a deputy defense minister, was killed at that time for apparently drinking during the mourning process for his father, along with some others. And we heard earlier this year that a ex-girlfriend, a member of the orchestra that you mentioned, was also executed.
Kim Jong-un's ex-girlfriend.
Yes, Kim Jong-un's ex-girlfriend, that he had her executed as well. And then, of course, both his father and his grandfather were known to have these purges as well as a means of gathering power and showing their might. But that certainly seems to be the case here. It was very public. It's a family member. And what message does that send but that no one is safe from this individual? And yes, you have a young leader. He's new. He's perhaps being challenged. And if we think about North Korea, we've got about 25 million people. They have been impoverished for the last 15, 20 years, significantly impoverished. And he has to gather power. He has to bring power to the fore. And how do you do this but incite fear? And I would just point out that the other thing is that this all looks like this is happening. But on the other hand, we're taking their word for it. We've not seen the execution. This is one of the few places in the world where we really don't know what is going on.
We have nobody inside that country that can provide us this information. A lot of this is being confirmed with satellite footage. I mean, we tend to know about the camps and the expansion of the camps, the labor camps, the imprisonment of these people because those camps are growing. And that's all from a distance that we're looking at this. So what really we come down to here is that we still, once again, we just cannot know what's going on in North Korea. We are just speculating.
Well,
many
in this country have acknowledged that we have no indication that this is not true. And so we are going to assume that it's true. But of course, this is one of the largest propaganda machines in the world. And they are using that, again, to solidify power.
Well, frustrating nonetheless to know that something seems to be going on in North Korea and we have a hard time knowing the facts, let alone understanding it. Well, off to another frustrating situation. Joshua, let's talk about Syria. Now, of course, you know, what's really big in the news right now is the destruction of Syria's chemical weapons. They did sign that agreement that they would remove all their chemical weapons from the country. And in fact, what's going on right now is that chemical weapons from 12 sites, and we're talking about sarin gas, mustard gas, going from 12 different sites in Syria by Russian ship to Danish and Norwegian ships to an Italian port, which will then be loaded onto some unnamed U.S. naval ship. And then these chemicals will be destroyed out at sea. So all of that going on at the same time, bloody civil war. And so some, of course, are concerned that this is going to be delayed, that the fighting is interfering. But there's an awful lot going on here just with the fighting itself, let alone the destruction of the chemical weapons. So, Joshua, tell us, what is going on in Syria?
You're absolutely right. The chemical weapons side is the happy side of this. They do seem to be being sent and will be destroyed. If not exactly on schedule, everything is in the works. The scarier part is what's going on inside Syria. And there we've seen that American-sponsored rebels or supported rebels, moderate rebels, quote unquote, were expelled from Syria, driven out by more radical jihadists. And now the United States is torn. They're worried that if Assad falls, Syria could turn into a Somalia, but not only just a Somalia, one where a transnational threat, al-Qaeda, could take root. So they're torn. Saudi Arabia says, we're going to go it alone. If you don't support the rebels, we are, because radicalism is being created by Assad. That's their argument. We have to destroy Assad totally before moderation will return to Syria. The United States isn't sure of that. They believe perhaps that if Assad goes, it'll become more radical. So that's the quandary that everybody is in right now. And we are hearing lots of American ex-CIA people come out and say, maybe we don't want Assad to go. Saudi is saying, yes, we do. And this is the tug of war going on right now.
Well, clearly getting those chemical weapons out of the country is going to be critical given the instability that is already there and that may become worse. But the question is how do we even trust that this process is going to end happily? As you said, that the happy news is the chemical weapons. But can we really trust that given all the other stuff that's going on in this country that Assad isn't going to hold back a little bit here? I mean,
well, he may very well hold back. I think the point is that tons of chemical weapons are being destroyed, which would not have been destroyed if we had just struck Assad with some bombing raids. And Russian-U.S. cooperation has led to a great deal. And the hope is that a Geneva II process, which is supposed to take place next month, with the Russians and Americans bringing both sides to the table, could lead to some kind of peace process. Today looks very iffy, does not look like it's going to happen anytime soon. What we've seen is a radicalization of the situation in Syria, gobs of new refugees flowing out, poverty, suffering. Snow has fallen across the Middle East, one of the biggest snowstorms, and people have been freezing to death. Very sad stories coming out of Syria.
Yeah, definitely the bad news there. Well, Joshua, Rebecca, thank you as always for your thoughts about these issues.
It's always a pleasure.
If you have any thoughts about this discussion or a question for me or any of our panelists, let us know in the comments section of the Worldviews page of KGOU.org. This show is also on Twitter at WorldviewsKGOU and at Suzette Gorlot, at Cruz226, and at Joshua_Landis. Next, I'll talk about sanitation and hygiene concerns in the developing world with scientists working in Ethiopia, China, and India. I'm Suzette Gorlot, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorlot. Today, I'm joined by three scientists who focus on water issues in Africa and Asia. Feleke Zog is an environmental chemist and engineer at Addis Ababa University in Ethiopia's capital city. Pawan Labsetwar is a scientist at India's National Environmental Engineering Research Institute. And Derek Chitwood focuses on China and Myanmar with the non-governmental organization Partners in Hope. Feleke Zog, Pawan Labsetwar, and Derek Chitwood, thank you so much for joining me today on Worldviews. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
So all of you work in the area of water, sanitation, and hygiene. You've been visiting our water center here, and yet you're working in different parts of the world. So I'd like to hear a little bit just very quickly from each of you about the part of the world that you're working in and what is the most concerning issue in terms of what you're focusing on. So, Feleke, would you like to begin? You do your work in Ethiopia. What is the main water concern that we have in Ethiopia?
Yeah, Ethiopia is one of the least countries in terms of water supply and sanitation coverage in the world. Basically, microbial contamination of water sources and coverage is very low. Access to safe water is very low, particularly in rural part of the country. And on top of that, we have also limitations in terms of technologies, water supply or water treatment technologies. In addition to that, we have also contaminations from natural geological formation sources, so, such as fluoride.
So fluoride, yeah. Some of the work you've been doing, yeah.
These are the major issues in Ethiopia.
Okay. Well, Pawan, what about your work in India?
Yeah. See, we are the second most populous country in the world with a population of around 1.24 billion. Do we have sufficient rainfall? There is a regional variability in rainfall. So part of India now suffers with water scarcity, particularly western part and southern peninsula. And in addition, we have problems with water quality also. We have problems like high fluoride, arsenic, nitrate, iron in our water. And third is sanitation and hygiene. Though we have reached the target of about 60% access to population as far as the sanitation is concerned, but there are almost 400 million Indians who do not have access to sanitation. So we are trying to improve that. And these are the major problems. And then we are trying our level best to address these issues in India.
And Derek, how about in China? You work in China and Myanmar both, right, or somewhere on the border?
Predominantly in China. I've been in China for the last 12 years and working there. Predominantly, our concern is water that has a lot of microorganisms in it. We've seen a lot of places where the microbial count is just really out of the off the scale. And because of this, we're looking predominantly at that. There are a few places where there is also some heavy metals such as fluoride or arsenic, but 99% of the places where we work just have a lot of microorganisms in the water. And because of that, children are getting sick. People are dying early.
So clearly the connection between problems with the water and health crises and therefore development, being able to develop in each of your countries as developing nations. So it sounds like you have a lot of similarities here. But I'd like to ask, would you say that the issue is less one about access to water, the supply of water, but the supply of clean water or drinkable water or water that has too many bacterial agents or something in the water that makes it undrinkable, or sanitation issues of, you know, being able to have proper toilets and disposal of waste?
All three are key where I work. There are a lot of places where there are no latrines. And so the custom of the people is that they just go up into the forest beyond the village. And so when it rains, all that washes down into their springs. And therefore, when they drink that water, they get sick. Then there's other places where they have also no water. And so they're actually carrying the water from a long distance. But even that source is a river, which is not a safe place for getting water. And so we really have all three aspects. We have to build more latrines so people have a place to properly store and dispose of their waste products. But also we need to get water for people, and then we need to make sure that it is safe for them to be drinking.
Yeah, there seems to be interconnectivity between poor sanitation and water quality. Yeah, and we have seen that constructing toilets doesn't help people. We have to encourage people to use those toilets. And and that's the major work which we are now doing. And then we have already prepared a communication plan through which we are trying to communicate to the community that how useful it is to use the toilet, so that not only we control the feces, but we can keep our water safe. And microbiological quality is also a major concern, which offers a major disease burden, particularly among children.
Yeah, I think it's the same also in Ethiopia. The access is very low, which means that if there is no access, then you can't think of sanitation.
So the supply, even, they're just having enough water. It's not just you don't have clean water, you don't have water at all.
Yeah, so it's difficult to achieve the health targets.
I'm speaking with Feleke Zog, Pawan Labsetwar, and Derek Chitwood about water and sanitation issues in Africa and Asia. More of our conversation right after this break. I'm Suzette Gourlat, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gourlat, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. My guests are Feleke Zog, Pawan Labsetwar, and Derek Chitwood, three scientists who were in Norman earlier this year for OU's annual water conference. When we left off, Labsetwar described the connection between an area's water quality and the poor sanitation of its residents. I mean, each of you are working in areas where, you know, perhaps it's difficult to overcome some cultural practices regarding water and sanitation and how these things are communicated to the community. Could you tell us a little bit about that? I mean, there's the issue of kind of engineering filtration and all of that sort of work to clean the water. But then there's that social side of it, of communicating it to the public and ensuring that they know what to do and how to use these products and change their practices to not go off into the forest as they've always done before, but to use the latrine, for example?
Yeah, it's a very interesting question. We earlier had tried engineering solutions to the problem and it really didn't work. And then, as I told you, we have prepared a communication plan. And then in India, we have Bollywood actors and cricketers who are very famous. So we are trying to involve these Bollywood actors and cricketers so that they can communicate with the community, because if we involve them, we are sure that the message will reach to the community. So we have decided that it's not only engineering problem, but we have to really communicate to the community that unless you use the toilet, there is no use of constructing the toilet.
I would say that, I just think that that's brilliant to get the famous cricketers and such people. It really has a great impact because people, for example, our NGO makes ceramic water filters, which can remove almost all of the microorganisms, so the water is safe to drink. But getting them to use it when, the water's right there. And there's a mentality where I work that if it's clear, it's good to drink. And yet there could be thousands of harmful microorganisms in there. So how do you change that? So one of the ways that we do it is we try to get students from Beijing or other influential areas to come and promote and, well, if they use it, we're going to use it mentality. And so the social engineering, the social change of way people think is far more important than the engineering aspect. You need both.
Yeah, because you could clean up the water, but then you don't have
nobody uses it, or the
latrines, you know, that nobody uses. So what do you think needs to be done? I mean, each of you working on a very local level, I would imagine. But, you know, is there more international awareness that needs to be managed about this? Do international organizations need to be buying in and facilitating the type of work that you're doing? Or is this really a ground up, grassroots level, people at the local level need to be buying in more, or some combination of the two? What would you say are some of the common solutions, or are there common solutions that you're facing in these areas?
Yeah. Okay, though there is a similarity between the problem in Ethiopia, India, and China, but I feel the solution should come from within. Because it's a local issue, and then as you rightly pointed out, it's a cultural issue also. So to deal with the cultural issues, if we can find out, good plan to communicate with them, keeping their culture interest protected, I'm sure that it can be handled. And we really got good progress over the last 5-6 years when we tried to, communicate with the community. And I hope that we'll try to do much better than in the past.
I think it's the best way in Ethiopia. According to my experience, it would be more appropriate to empower the local communities and build capacities at grassroots level. We can use different wash advocacy approach. And it didn't, for several years, it didn't work. So we have to think how to really empower the communities and how to we should be able to make them understand the situation.
But what about governments? So inevitably, governments are involved in all of your work in some way, shape, or form. Are they helpful? Are they an impediment? Are they supporting this type of work? I mean, if you want to empower people at the local level, you know, do you do that working with governments, outside of governments? What is the method that you're using in that regard?
We have to work with the local governments. We're an international NGO, and so it's their home, so we need to respect them a lot. Secondly, they need to understand the situation so they can promote it. We worked with the party secretary of a county who we were providing filters to schools, and they really thought that they were unnecessary because the water was clear. But when we showed them the petri dishes full of microorganisms from the water that was coming out of their taps, it opened their eyes for the very first time, and they realized they can't just provide water. They have to provide biologically safe water for these children to drink. And so then from there, they opened the door wide open and said, oh, yes, please come in. So part of it, we need to be working with them to educate the local officials so that they will open the door so that more grassroots work can be done.
Yeah. In India, it's predominantly being done by government. We also face a problem in convincing government officials sometimes what are the proper solutions. And we have to also demonstrate through evidence-based research or implementation studies that, okay, if you adopt a certain approach, it may prove helpful. And then they can channelize their fundings in replicating those interventions in India. And it's really good to be here in Oklahoma to participate in this international conference to know more about an international experience so that we can go back and try to implement some solution which have been successfully practiced elsewhere in the world.
We have really the government structure is up to the local level, so it's up to the communities. So we have health extension workers in each community. So it's good to link all efforts to the government, particularly to the local government. So I think we cannot bring any change without strengthening the local government.
So local government capacity building as well as
right.
capacity
very
building
important.
Within the communities.
Very important.
Well, very important work and certainly very challenging, I'm sure. But thank you, Feleke, Pawan, and Derek, for being with us today on Worldviews to talk about this important issue.
Thank you for your
time. You very much.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to my conversation with Feleke Zog, Pawan Labsetwar, and Derek Chitwood. We have a transcript of this interview on our website, kgou.org. KGOU produces Worldviews alongside the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. Brian Hardzinski produces the show and writes our content for the web, and Hillary Gibson prepared the research for this interview. Join us a week from today when we look back on the year's international events and offer up our global predictions for 2014. For Rebecca Cruz and Joshua Landis, I'm Suzette Grelott.